Welcome to Pomegranate Health, a podcast about the culture of medicine. I'm Mick Cavazzini for the Royal Australasian College of Physicians. Whatever specialty you're in, I'm sure you've heard the hype around semaglutide. In the media, it's usually referred to by the brand names Ozempic or Wegovy, and it's held up as some kind of weight loss miracle cure. Over the last year, the drug raked in estimated sales of $12.5 billion for its manufacturer, Novo Nordisk. This didn't just make it the most valuable listed company in Europe, but it boosted Denmark's GDP by almost 2%. Demand for semaglutide is so high that it's been hard to supply the patients with type 2 diabetes for whom it was first indicated, and Australia's Therapeutic Goods Administration has been warning prescribers not to start new patients on it. We'll talk about this supply bottleneck later, but let's start with the basics. Type 2 diabetes is characterized by resistance to insulin and dysfunction of the pancreatic beta cells which secrete it. This means that spikes in blood glucose are not brought under control, contributing to cardiovascular disease and renal failure. 80 to 90% of patients with the disease are obese, and in fact, insulin resistance often comes about from the organella dysfunction and oxidative stress associated with obesity. While exercise and dietary modification are the preferred interventions, adherence is hard to maintain. Enter semaglutide, an analogue of glucagon-like peptide 1. GLP-1 is known as an incretin hormone, meaning that it's released into the gut in response to a meal. It stimulates activity of pancreatic beta cells and also reduces secretion of glucagon, which would otherwise signal the liver to release more glucose for circulation. As well as these direct effects on glycemic control, we'll hear later how GLP-1 can modulate appetite in a couple of different ways. The effects of endogenous GLP-1 only last a few minutes since it's quickly degraded, but semaglutide survives for days and can be administered once a week by subcutaneous injection. Semaglutide was first registered by the US Federal Drugs Administration in December 2017 and by the TGA in August 2019. But it's not the first GLP-1 receptor agonist to hit the shelves. That was AstraZeneca's exenatide about a decade earlier, before Novo Nordisk came out with one called liraglutide. Eli Lilly joined the party in 2015 with dulaglutide, but it's about to really shake things up with a potent dual receptor agonist called tirzepatide. In a recent systematic review for the Internal Medicine Journal, Australian physicians sought to clarify how well semaglutide holds up against the other drugs in this class. One of the principal investigators was gastroenterologist Professor Chris Rayner. I called him in Adelaide alongside endocrinologist Professor Gary Wittert.
So I'm Chris Rayner. I work at the Adelaide Medical School, University of Adelaide, as a clinical academic, but I'm also a gastroenterologist and active in that side of my clinical practice.
Gary Wittert, I'm an endocrinologist and professor of medicine at the University of Adelaide. I'm based at South Australian Institute of Health and Medical Research and practice clinically at the Royal Adelaide Hospital.
Okay. Chris, let's use that systematic review in the IMJ as a starting point from trainee physician Brandon Stretton and a bunch of your other colleagues. It wasn't a meta-analysis so much as a look at head-to-head comparisons between semaglutide and the various other GLP-1 receptor agonists in adult patients with type 2 diabetes. Dr. Stretton identified 5 papers published between 2016 and 2021, all sponsored by Novo Nordisk or Eli Lilly. They reported that 1 milligram of semaglutide delivered weekly for 40 weeks causes drops in glycated hemoglobin of 1.5 to 1.8%. The next closest competitor in this class was dulaglutide, with reductions of up to 1.4%. How impressive is the anti-hypoglycemic effect of semaglutide compared to the existing standard of care?
Well, the anti-hypoglycemic effect is quite impressive, I would say. The big advantage of this group of drugs over other injectables, so particularly long-acting insulin, are that their lowering of blood glucose is glucose-dependent. They only stimulate insulin secretion when the blood glucose is elevated. So they're much less prone to result in hypoglycemia. Certainly, until we have tirzepatide, which we'll speak more about, semaglutide was the most effective of the other GLP-1 receptor agonists so far. It's longer acting than some of the original ones, so there's more persistent exposure to drug, which is good for fasting glucose lowering in particular.
Mm. But semaglutide was trumped by tirzepatide, which reduced HbA1c by 2.1% at the 5 milligram dose and by 2.4% at the 15 milligram dose. Tirzepatide, or Mounjaro, is Eli Lilly's latest contribution. It doesn't just bind the GLP-1 receptor, but also that of another incretin hormone called glucose-dependent insulinotropic polypeptide. Does GIP receptor agonism recruit additional pathways, or does it just amplify the same ones recruited by GLP-1?
It should be noted that the superiority of tirzepatide has, to a certain extent, got to do with its superiority for weight loss.
Okay.
So you're getting far more weight loss, and the reduction in adipose tissue mass is going to, under any circumstances, increase beta cell function.
But it's fair to say that the scientific community is divided as to what the GIP receptor has to add to GLP-1 receptor stimulation in tirzepatide. So there's a lot of complex pharmacology around receptors. And for instance, the way tirzepatide interacts means that the GLP-1 receptor is not internalized so well, right. So it's more available. So it makes it a super GLP-1 compound compared to semaglutide, for instance, whereas its effect on the GIP receptor tends to allow that receptor to be internalized, and GIP, it may even act as a functional GIP antagonist. If you look at data from murine studies, there's data showing that GIP might be good for weight loss, and GIP antagonism may be good for weight loss. So it's an extremely complicated area. It's interesting to note that there are polymorphisms for the GIP receptor, and people who've got these that have a lesser function of the receptor do tend to have a leaner phenotype. So, yeah, that's interesting. And it's a fascinating comment, perhaps, that you've got a drug that's now come to market and we don't really understand the mechanisms completely.
Interesting. So there are layers of effect here. You've just mentioned weight loss. That was actually a surprise bonus identified in the early trials. In the particular studies included in your review, Chris, diabetes patients lost 6 to 7% of their pre-intervention weight with semaglutide. This was about twice as effective as the other single-acting agents, but not as good as tirzepatide, which had an 8 to 13% effect on weight, depending on dose. By contrast, classic interventions for hypoglycemia like insulin and sulfonylurea medications often lead to weight gain. So is this dual impact of the incretin agonists enough to consider it a paradigm shift in diabetes management?
I think it should be regarded as a paradigm shift, but I think the other thing that's worth noting is the additional benefits of this class of therapy as far as cardiovascular protection and renal protection goes. It does share that in common with the SGLT2 inhibitors, which are currently more available and less expensive. But there are subtleties between which of those drugs to choose between in different situations. But certainly cardiovascular protection and renal protection are two big draw cards of the GLP-1 class.
Do you think that the effects on cardiovascular and renal are the consequence of weight loss or some GLP-1 independent effect? Do you have a view on that?
I'm not at the top of my head sure of animal models to differentiate weight loss from other effects.
And why I raise that is the data on bariatric surgery for improving renal function and decreasing proteinuria, as well as for cardiovascular protection, is excellent. And I don't think one can invoke sustained GLP-1-based effects to the same magnitude.
Gary, I'll hold that thought because I think I want to end there with the comparison to bariatric surgery. So, yeah, we talked about the weight loss, other secondary outcomes, changes in waist circumference and systolic blood pressure also followed a similar pattern with these drugs. But before we hand the trophy to tirzepatide, we do need to consider side effects. So with semaglutide, you get nausea in about 20% of patients and vomiting in half as many, diarrhea in 12 to 15%, but constipation in another handful. Fewer than 1% experienced hypoglycemia, gallbladder disorders or pancreatitis in these studies. For tirzepatide, the numbers were pretty similar at the lower doses and a fraction higher at 15 milligrams. And discontinuation rates due to adverse events for both drugs were under 10%. Is there anything remarkable about that safety profile?
I think that it's been very much underplayed in the clinical trials. Certainly, it's acknowledged that the rates of GI adverse effects are high and they're mainly mild to moderate, and they tend to be greatest in about the first month of therapy, eased by slow up titration of the dose. But if you look at the fine detail, there's still some persisting GI symptoms even after 12 months use. And in a clinical trial, there's a lot of support to cajole patients into staying in the trial. So something like a 7 or 8% dropout due to GI adverse effects looks very good, but I suspect you would be able to maintain mm-hmm. that sort of rate in a real world setting. In fact, I think if you look at community pharmacy dispensing data for GLP-1 receptor agonists, at about 12 months, only about half the people are still taking the prescribed drug.
You mean like as it's semaglutide?
A range of, I can't remember whether semaglutide was in this analysis because it goes back a few years.
Yeah, I think semaglutide is differently tolerated and the difference is weight loss. In clinical practice, I've not seen any patients or very few patients come back and say, I don't want to take semaglutide. And that stands in marked contrast to liraglutide and dulaglutide, where there were a significant proportion of patients who said they didn't want to take that. With Byetta or exenatide, it was even higher. Very few of my patients wanted to take it. You know, we've done trials with topiramate, which in its earliest formulation was extremely toxic in terms of adverse events. And people were losing a lot of weight, didn't want to withdraw from the trial because of the weight loss. So I think that if the weight loss is significant, people will tolerate the nausea, which is quite a remarkable observation, I think.
Okay. So discontinuation is one potential negative in the column of these GLP-1 agonists. Tirzepatide hasn't yet been launched in Australia. But as it stands, even semaglutide is not the first-line option for type 2 diabetes in the eyes of the advisory committee to the pharmaceutical benefits scheme. To qualify for the PBS subsidy, a diabetes patient also has to be receiving metformin or sulfonylureas and have a contraindication or intolerance to the combination of that pair. Patients must also have had an HbA1c above 7% despite treatment with those meds. And then there are some complicated rules about accepted HbA1c thresholds once gliptin, glitazone, or SGLT2 inhibitors have been started. Are all these hurdles put up by the PBS simply about the cost of the drug to Medicare and to the taxpayer?
Well, yeah, I mean, that may be some of the rationale. I can't speak for the TGA, but from a point of view of logic, I don't think sulfonylureas make any sense at all. Not in the current environment. I mean, they cause hypoglycemia potentially. They lead to weight gain. Despite their efficacy, and some of that efficacy is lost with time, they're potentially cardiotoxic in comparison to other drugs. So I think the starting point of metformin makes perfectly good sense. You know, metformin is extremely cheap, you know, $9 a month if you buy it on a private script, maximum 12, I think. Of course, there's some people who won't tolerate metformin, but I suspect there are also the people who won't tolerate semaglutide. A DPP-4 inhibitor is weight neutral but effective. And of course, SGLT2 inhibitors are extremely effective if they're used appropriately as an add-on to metformin, with also cardiac and renal benefits. Mm-hmm. And in fact, may well be more cost-effective. However, if someone is significantly affected by obesity with multiple end-organ effects, then there's no question that the weight loss of semaglutide makes enormous sense.
That's an interesting point, yeah. So how big an effect do you need? How far above the threshold are they?
And then there'll be other subtleties that you'll take into account in the algorithm, like cardiovascular risk in particular.
Mm-hmm. Going by the PBS website, it seems that the government gets Ozempic into the country at $133 for 3 weeks of therapy, though with the PBS subsidy, the patient only pays $30. Meanwhile, Eli Lilly's application to have their tirzepatide formulation Mounjaro listed on the PBS for the same narrow range of diabetes indications was rejected entirely. Again, is it a good guess that Eli Lilly wanted too much money for it and that our health minister called their bluff?
No question about it. It was never going to wash that if Lilly wanted $400 or $500 or whatever it is for Mounjaro, that they were going to get it on the PBS. So I don't know what Lilly were thinking, other than the fact that so many people may be desperate to get it, that they may be prepared to pay those outrageous fees.
If money were no object, would Would you want to have tirzepatide listed?
Well, I think you have to have money in the equation. We have limited healthcare budgets. Resources are precious. And if we've got an effective drug that's a quarter of the price, that's what we should be using. And it's very effective. Does the extra weight loss make a huge difference clinically? I don't think we know that. I don't think we have head-to-head outcome studies. Yes, it might be nice. Is it super important? No data.
Given the remarkable weight loss in trials in patients with diabetes, Novo Nordisk started testing GLP-1 receptor agonists in people who were obese or with other comorbidities relating to excess weight. In one paper published in 2021, it was reported that semaglutide at 2.4 mg weekly for 68 weeks led to an almost 15% decline in body weight. A trial of tirzepatide in the same sort of cohort achieved up to 20% weight loss. So we're talking two or three times the effect size we described from the diabetes studies. Both trials were double-blind, placebo-controlled, and published in the New England Journal of Medicine. But wait, there's more. Eli Lilly has just published the findings of a phase 2 trial of a triple receptor agonist called retrorutide. This also hits the glucagon receptor on top of those for GLP-1 and GIP. Participants assigned to a 12 mg weekly dose lost on average 24% of body weight after 48 weeks. This is getting close to the realm achieved with bariatric surgery, but it does come with a fair few side effects that need further investigation. Either way you look at it, though, it compares very favourably to what's normally achieved by people through dieting and lifestyle change, and we know how frustrated dieters get from the difficulty of keeping weight off. Probably the largest cohort that's been tracked longitudinally has been the US National Weight Loss Registry. In 2005, researchers reported that 20% of overweight individuals were successful at losing at least 10% of initial body weight and keeping that off for at least a year. Other reviews usually put the success rate at half of that, but either way, this leaves a lot of people struggling with unwanted or unhealthy kilos. One popular theory is that we all have a metabolic set point, a narrow weight range which our body and brain strive to stay within. So even if you reduce your caloric intake, your metabolism just slows down so that fewer calories are burnt and absorbed, meaning that weight loss isn't as dramatic as hoped for. This would have been life-saving for prehistoric humans struggling through lean winters and droughts, but not so appreciated by those of us leading an indulgent first-world lifestyle. The metabolic set point doesn't just influence your GI tract, but also your brain, with some of the very same hormones acting centrally to drive your appetite. The contribution of incretins to this is suggested by the widespread expression of their receptors. One of Chris Rayner's research interests is how GLP-1 suppresses gastric motility, and therefore how quickly nutrients pass through the stomach and gut.
Well, again, the interesting thing is that people view the main mechanism of stimulation of insulin secretion. In fact, that's only one mechanism. It will do that when your blood glucose is elevated. But because it's slowing emptying, actually the demand for insulin is less because you're slowing the release of carbohydrate into the small intestine for absorption. So there are multiple mechanisms of action here. These hormones are released to a greater degree from the distal than the proximal gut. And one of the reasons why we've got them is to help prevent nutrients racing too quickly through the gut. Nutrients that are exposed to the distal gut will provoke a great response with not only GLP-1, but also other hormones like PYY, which subsequently feeds back to slow gastric emptying and retard small intestinal transit. So you're really trying to spare nutrients for digestion and absorption rather than let them pass unabsorbed through the gut. That's the physiological function of these hormones.
Maybe paint the picture a little bit more. Are there GLP-1 receptors right on the smooth muscles of the gut, or is it acting through intermediates like ghrelin or leptin or whatever?
Yeah, so a lot of the action of GLP-1 is paracrine, so it's acting locally in the gut and stimulating vagal nerve endings, and it's via those nerve impulses that we get effects on motility to a large degree. Yeah, that's a major part of the satiation side of the hormones. Mm-hmm. There are also central components to hormone action as far as the appetite effects go. Mm. So we talk about satiation as feeling that you've had enough during a meal, and a gut hormone classically signals like that. But then you've got satiety, which really talks about the length of time before you want to start eating again. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't expect a gut hormone, pure and simple, to have much effect on satiety. And yet this does seem to be an effect of GLP-1 receptor agonists. We're only just beginning to understand the neural circuitry. Most of these studies are done on rodents, and there are substantial differences in physiology and the incretins between rodents and humans. So this is why there's a lot of confusion about mechanisms.
I've just got a one-line note here, a 2017 study where subjects were offered ad libitum food and energy consumption was reduced by 35% over 12 weeks. And there's evidence of GLP-1 receptors in the brainstem, the hypothalamus, and afferents of the vagus nerve too. I was struck with sympathy by this comment reported in the New Yorker from a member of a support group for overweight people. Quote, "No wonder that skinny people think heavy people have no willpower. Their brains actually do tell them to stop eating. I had no idea."
Well, I have a patient with Prader-Willi syndrome, or many patients with Prader-Willi syndrome, a disorder where their brain doesn't register any degree of satiety or satiation. They're hungry constantly, and doesn't matter how much they eat, that sensation remains. And one of the young men I look after had a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass and said to me afterwards, "For the first time, I know what it's like to feel slightly full. And so, you know, these are very interesting mechanisms with many, many pathways that impact on them. Mm-hmm. And one of those pathways, which uses GLP-1 as a mediator, works on the hedonic aspects of feeding, so the pleasure of food. One of the things that people who go on this drug tell us is that they're much less likely to pick highly palatable processed carbohydrate foods. And in fact, there is some suggestion that these drugs will modify addiction, for example, to alcohol. So this is a very interesting pathway and is also important in the action of the drug.
It's also one of the things that people with successful outcomes from bariatric surgery report, isn't it, Gary?
Exactly correct. Yeah, and you can abrogate that effect by blocking the hormones with somatostatin. And they suddenly say that those appetite sensations and drive for carbohydrate food comes back. So, you know, the physiology of obesity and maintenance of fat mass is very, very striking. And I don't think we should ever consider that people with obesity have a lack of willpower. None of them want to be like that.
One of my reviewers shared some literature with me showing improvement in patients with confirmed metabolic dysfunction-associated steatohepatitis. Doesn't roll off the tongue quite as easily as non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. After 72 weeks, the disease was resolved in 60% of patients taking semaglutide every week at just 0.4 milligrams. Can you spell out the mechanisms a bit more bluntly? Is it simply that reduced caloric intake causes more reliance on burning of fat to provide energy, or are there more direct effects, you know, downregulation of lipogenesis, that kind of thing?
GLP-1 has effects on the accumulation of intrahepatic fat. Mm-hmm. So there's certainly a component to the physiology that involve effects on intermediary metabolism. But, you know, clearly the low dose indicates that the efficacy is separate from pure weight loss.
Certainly with metabolic associated fatty liver disease, if you can get to the early stages, that's when you stand the greatest chance of avoiding progression. And we've got to remember that this is now the most common cause of cirrhosis and liver deaths in the advanced world. What we're less clear about is that it's going to have an impact on established fibrosis. We haven't got a lot of liver biopsy studies yet to tell us about this, but there's some interest in combinations with other compounds that might have more of an antifibrotic effect.
So in the 2021 Novo Nordisk study in obese and overweight patients specifically, semaglutide also caused significant improvements in blood pressure, lipid levels, C-reactive protein, as well as HbA1c. And patients also reported improvement in reported quality of life and physical functioning. And there were similar findings from a double-blind trial published in the New England Journal just in September in overweight patients who had heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. Will this have cardiologists reaching for their script book as well as endocrinologists?
Well, absolutely. I mean, cardiologists reach for their script book in the case of SGLT2 inhibitors now. And they're both on the PBS. Well, certainly for renal disease, it's on the PBS. You don't need to have diabetes and so on. But whether, again, this is an effect of a reduction in weight, which I think is very much the case, rather than anything specific about GLP-1 is a question. I rather think it's substantially weight, although there are GLP-1 receptors in cardiac tissue. So, the jury's out a little bit.
There was a stronger criticism of this trial in patients with heart failure in Medscape's This Week in Cardiology podcast. Cardiologist John Mandrola, MD, argued that any obese person will report feeling better when they lose a significant amount of weight, regardless what comorbidities they have. And the functional outcomes were hardly astounding. Participants taking semaglutide increased the distance they could walk in 6 minutes from a median of 320 meters to 340. Given that the study enrolled just 529 people and didn't track any relevant clinical outcomes such as rate of heart failure associated hospitalization, Dr. Mandrola described it as, quote, marketing masquerading as science. But just one day before our podcast went live, his wishes may have been answered with an advanced publication in the New England Journal of Medicine. This was a multi-center RCT that recruited over 17,500 participants who were overweight with some pre-existing cardiovascular disease, but not diabetes. For example, 68% had had prior myocardial infarction, and there was also a significant proportion with risk factors like dyslipidemia. The participants were mostly men with an average age of 61 years. The intervention group received 2.4 milligrams semaglutide weekly, and both they and the placebo group were all enrolled in a lifestyle program as well. The primary cardiovascular endpoint was a composite of deaths from cardiovascular causes, non-fatal heart attack, or non-fatal stroke. There was a clear separation in the cumulative incidence curves from the moment participants were randomized. At the mean follow-up of 3 years and 4 months, the primary endpoint occurred in 6.5% of people administering semaglutide, compared to 8% of people in the placebo group. While this was significant, slight improvements in the confirmatory endpoints did not quite meet the significance threshold. Those included death from cardiovascular causes and heart failure-associated outcomes. Participants taking semaglutide lost only 9% of their pre-intervention weight at the two-year mark, but there were huge declines in CRP and triglycerides, along with a small increase in beneficial HDL cholesterol. Professor Whithert is still inclined to attribute these benefits principally to weight loss, but the findings do lend confidence to there being cardiovascular benefits of GLP-1 agonist therapy in high-risk, non-diabetic patients. So how are indications for weight loss being handled by regulators and prescribers? Novo Nordisk relaunched semaglutide under the name Wegovy in 2021, with doses up to 2.4 milligrams per shot. But the indications for use are very narrow. Patients must have a body mass index over 30, which is the obese range, or over 27 in the presence of at least one weight-related comorbidity. While the TGA site doesn't spell any of these out, the FDA gives a couple of suggestions, notably hypertension or dyslipidemia. As we've heard, steatohepatitis would be another good candidate. I asked Gary Whithert how liberal you'd be with other comorbidities, such as sleep apnea.
It's difficult because to treat sleep apnea, you have to lose around 20% or more of body weight to resolve it. Now, improving sleep apnea doesn't mean you can give up your CPAP. You may still need your CPAP. And then there's the question of different phenotypes of sleep apnea. So, yes, I know that ResMed shares have gone down 36%. That's profoundly premature. I want to be absolutely clear that any notion that this should abrogate proper patient assessment, identification of comorbidities, and targeted treatment for those comorbidities in the hope that someone spending vast sums of money every month will solve the problem. We don't know that. And I think you have to look at how to classify someone in terms of current state of health. So if you have a look, at a staging scale, and there's some very nice staging scales where you can look at psychological and physical risk and the magnitude of obesity, and, you know, are you in the green, the yellow, or the red of an Edmonton staging scale, for example. That's extremely helpful to work out a threshold for where this should be applied. Vague guidance, I think, is going to create some distortion of the market and is also going to raise some issues in terms of health equity about who can afford it, who will get it, you know, and so on. I think there are lots of questions that have to be answered.
That's a great answer. Wegovy hasn't actually been launched in Australia because Novo Nordisk's request for a PBA listing was rejected not once but twice, even for this narrow cohort of obese and overweight patients. One of my reviewers, I guess playing the devil's advocate to the argument you've just made, one of my reviewers asked why there is this distinction being made compared to diabetes patients who do benefit from a PBS subsidy. Is it just about clinical efficacy versus available options, as you've already discussed? Or do you think there is some moral judgment creeping into those decisions as well?
Well, it would be nice to think there's no moral judgment, but there is. We all have implicit biases. But I think implicit biases make it either less likely that you're going to prescribe or lazy because you don't want to deal with lifestyle change.
Well, is there a cohort, however narrow, for whom you think a PBS listing is appropriate?
Yeah, I mean, starting at the top, someone who is profoundly physically, emotionally, psychologically, and functionally incapacitated by severe obesity, no question. So let's start there. And then as you start coming down the layers, you know, with significant cardiac disease and cardiac failure, you know, severe renal disease awaiting a transplant, you know, someone with intractable benign intracranial hypertension, where you've got, you know, limited options to deal with it, despite maybe putting in shunts or using diazoxide. So you can come down with a hierarchy of need. And I think that's why staging systems are useful.
Well, perhaps the scale of the problem is also part of PBAC's reasoning, considering that 31% of Australians are obese and 36% are overweight. Fatty liver disease is six times more prevalent than type 2 diabetes. Maybe they just don't think that Medicare can afford all these drugs, but there are also costs of not intervening. That same reviewer of mine wondered if treating people early for serious weight problems would pay for itself in fewer admissions for liver failure, cardiovascular interventions, even knee replacements.
There's no evidence for that. I mean, there are models of cost efficacy done by ISA in the United States, which shows that at least based on the price in the USA, prescribing semaglutide for people without diabetes increases healthcare costs. It doesn't decrease healthcare costs. And I think we need to bear that in mind. And also, you know, let me be clear. If my diet consists of Willy's pies and Coke, and I eat less Willy's pies and Coke, and I lose weight, am I going to cost the healthcare system less? We don't know that. I certainly won't be healthier, and I don't think my longer-term health outcomes will be better despite losing weight.
A couple of my reviewers were worried that this easy fix could actually be permissive of continuing an unhealthy lifestyle.
Yeah, exactly. Eating less of a suboptimal diet and failing to get exercise and proper sleep and manage your stress may not lead to a better health outcome, even if you lose weight. By contrast, if I can be persuaded to adopt a better diet and exercise a little bit each day with some resistance and some aerobic without even necessarily being hungry and I get my sleep apnea treated, I will definitely have better outcomes, no question about it, and I won't necessarily have lost weight. So, you know, I think these are the debates that we ought to be having.
You talk about persuasion there, persuading your patients to get on board with lifestyle change. Does having this quick fix there on the shelf make that messaging harder?
I don't think it does. I mean, I use the analogy, you know, would you put ethanol blend in your Bentley? and would having a smaller tank allow you to put ethanol blend in your Bentley? Well, not really. And people get that. And I think when you actually have a frank discussion with people about the toxicity of inappropriate diets and processed foods, they get it. So, you know, people want to be healthier. They want the drug to help. And that said, of course, for some people, there is a cosmetic issue. But I think we need to separate that out. and be very clear about what's appropriate and inappropriate prescribing. But, you know, it's got to be packaged with proper health advice and proper monitoring.
Right. I asked before about where incretin analogs sit with regards to the standard of care for diabetes. But what about obesity? So bariatric surgery is an intervention with well-proven effectiveness. There's a much higher success rate than there is for dieting in terms of maintenance of weight loss. It has well-understood complications, and it also works out as being no more expensive than a year or two of medication therapy. So where do you stand on the options available for it?
Well, they're very limited because bariatric surgery, for the most part, is not available in public hospitals, despite the fact that for many people it's a life-saving operation and allows people with very severe, you know, grade 3 and 4 obesity to return to a socially and economically productive life. It keeps them out of hospital in the future. Most public hospitals are not offering a service. And in private, there are all sorts of strange procedures being done of questionable benefit other than for those who stand to profit out of it. So, you know, I think we need to think very carefully. For people with severe obesity problems, you know, grade 3 or 4, fantastic operation if it's the right operation, changes their outlook on life. Mm-hmm. And for people with diabetes, if it's done early enough in the disease, can lead to a sustained remission where no medication is required whatsoever. But even the best of bariatric surgery, people are treated as a lifelong chronic disease, and they need optimal nutrition, they need physical activity, they need people to look after their bones and all of those kind of things. I think on a health economics, on a health equity perspective, there needs to be broader availability of Roux-en-Y gastric bypass and accessibility to those people on an absolute equitable basis.
Gary, there must be quite a subset of patients who are so comorbid with their extreme obesity that they're not good surgical candidates.
The bigger you are and the more comorbid, the better the candidate you are, because medically you can get these people fit for surgery very quickly. You know, you treat the comorbidities, you get them onto a very low calorie diet, and, you know, within a few months you can have them on the table with the operation. Remember that you can get weight off people, you just can't keep it off.
Do you think that something like Ozempic has got a place?
Absolutely. Yeah, very much so. I think it's got a place to prep people for surgery. And it's also got a place for those people who've had surgery and are struggling with weight regain, which does sometimes happen.
There are, of course, many other benefits of lifestyle change that need to be weighed up in the calculus of how widely to spruik medications for weight loss. Good food and exercise benefit mental health, immune function, even susceptibility to cancer. But in the real world, there are psychological and socioeconomic barriers to wider take-up of lifestyle change. The marketing and the low cost of junk foods, the stigma that overweight people feel in a trendy gym, urban design that discourages walking or cycling. The allure of a pharmaceutical quick fix is sometimes just too hard to ignore. Starting in mid-2022, semaglutide had a meteoritic rise in the public awareness thanks to some cunning marketing, celebrity gossip, and of course, Elon Musk. When asked on the platform formerly known as Twitter about his ripped and healthy physique, Musk credited Wegovy. Dozens of celebrities became the subjects of fevered speculation as to whether their weight loss had been a little too miraculous. And unsurprisingly, hundreds of thousands of otherwise healthy people with a bit of undesired weight began asking their doctors for semaglutide too, or getting scammed into buying fake product online. The massive spike in demand worldwide has choked supply for diabetes patients. It's actually not the manufacture of the compound itself that has hit a wall, but of the injection devices and cartridges. And because the whole supply chain has been diverted, there's now also a shortage of insulin products using the same delivery system. Novo Nordisk can hardly be surprised by all this hype around their drug. Consumer-facing TV commercials in the US have a catchy jingle, and trumpet weight loss as one of the explicit benefits of the Ozempic Trizone, along with improved glycemic control and lowered CV risk. Only at the bottom of the advert does the fine print advise that Ozempic is not a weight loss drug. In Australia, where direct-to-consumer advertising of pharmaceuticals is prohibited, the TGA has taken the unusual step of reminding us of the million-dollar penalties and potential jail time. They've insisted that even social media influencers could be prosecuted for spruiking off-label applications of Ozempic. We said earlier that the full public price for Ozempic in this country is $133 for a 3-week supply. But people with off-label scripts have been paying $300 to $600 for it privately at the pharmacy. And in the USA, Wegovy has been sold at the equivalent of $1,500 Australian dollars. You can see why Eli Lilly intends to go ahead with the launch of tirzepatide by the end of the year, even without a PBS listing. Writing for The New Yorker, US journalist Gia Tolentino described how easy it was for her to get a script from a telehealth clinic without even needing to lie about her weight. Only in America, I thought, until I bumped into a woman recently who was getting Ozempic from her regular pharmacy at the low, low price of $30. She was in her mid-40s, a little burly, but quite strong and fit from an outdoorsy job. She told me she didn't have diabetes, the required indication for a PBS script, and that she'd simply told her GP that she'd like to lose 15 kilos, because the weight was making her a bit depressed. I asked Gary Wittert whether laissez-faire prescribing was contributing to the short supply of semaglutide in Australia, or whether it was mostly the struggle of getting it into the country in the first place.
Off-label prescribing, yeah. There's 50,000 scripts a month being written or dispensed for people who do not fit the PBS criteria in Australia. So it's entirely attributable to that. And it's being used by bodybuilders to cut. Why wouldn't you?
It beats running around the block in a garbage bag, doesn't it? Australian stocks of Ozempic did receive a boost in February, but then in June, Novo Nordisk warned that deliveries would still be limited into 2024. The PBS Advisory Committee has recommended that the medications, quote, be restricted to patients who are contraindicated, intolerant, or inadequately responsive to SGLT2 inhibitors. So semaglutide should only be a backup option. And as recently as September, the TGA advised prescribers not to start new diabetes patients on the medication. How consequential has this been for your patients?
It's been extremely consequential. I'll give you an example. I look after a man in his 40s. He's got schizophrenia. He's extremely incapacitated by schizophrenia. The drugs have made him extremely large.
Yeah.
And because he's so large, he won't go out of the house. I mean, he doesn't want to go out of the house because he's paranoid, but his diabetes is perfectly controlled on the semaglutide. He still needs his CPAP. It's not that fantastic that it reduces his weight to the extent, but it allows him to be more normal. And now he's off it. He gains another 10 kilograms and his blood sugar goes up and his triglycerides go up and so on. So these are sort of people where you don't want cycling of weight. You do want sustained supply, and it's the kind of person who's maximally disadvantaged by the absence of this medication.
You touched on this too. In March, the Pharmaceutical Benefits Advisory Committee irked GPs by suggesting that they should have a special authorization to prescribe. But should they even be initiating patients on semaglutide, or should that be left to endocrinologists who work through the options empirically?
Why? There's too many people with type 2 diabetes and the workload for endocrinologists would be excessive. But that should not abrogate GPs from behaving more responsibly, managing the patients according to what I think should be an acceptably defined and pre-specified framework. And I can tell you that patients who've been started on this, who shouldn't have been, are many. Now, that's before we get to the clinics that are allowing prescriptions over the telephone, who are sending the scripts to their own pharmacies. And I wonder whether those pharmacies have a privileged supply that they're able to get and what premium patients are being charged.
Well, that New Yorker journalist wrote that she was, even where there was limited supply of the Novo Nordisk product, she was able to get it supplied by a compounding pharmacy using semaglutide salts.
Oh, there's another scandal. Compounding pharmacies are making it known to GPs and patients that they can supply it. They're very careful about asking for the script to say semaglutide, not Ozempic.
Yep.
But we don't know what the patients actually get, and the patients don't know what they actually get. I think this is a very serious issue of bottom feeders entering the market and trying to capitalize on the distress of people unable to get their medication.
Yeah, I did find an Australian website that was advertising this service too. So, Novo Nordisk have an oral formulation due in Australia next year called Rybelsus. I'm sure that's intended solely to increase convenience for patients with the clinical indications we've talked about, but the media didn't get that memo. News.com.au report it as a weight loss drug first and then as a treatment for diabetes. And there's a book you can buy online called The Complete Guide on How to Use Rybelsus Medication to Lose Weight and Destroy Obesity. and it's a gift that keeps on giving for Nordisk. In an extension to one of the longer trials published in 2022, non-diabetic people who stopped taking semaglutide regained 2/3 of the weight they'd lost within a year. So it doesn't cure anything, but do you see it as a potential bridge to a healthier lifestyle, maybe allowing people to lose a bit of self-consciousness as well as weight and then gain the motivation to exercise?
No, because it'll just gain the desire for more drug. The reality is people will be motivated to a healthy lifestyle if they can see the benefits of the healthy lifestyle. Feeling better from lifestyle change is so motivating. And I want to separate that from weight loss, because I'm not talking about weight loss. I'm talking about feeling better at any weight. I look after a lot of men, and a lot of them have got diabetes and obesity or metabolic syndrome and erectile dysfunction, and their sexual function improves with weight loss.
Mm-hmm.
And that's highly motivating when they improve their diet and their overall pattern of living, and they get rid of the vast amount of alcohol and they get their depression treated. And then, they feel better. And then you can deal with the rest of their metabolic issues with some medication on top.
And finally, this popularization, we don't really know what are the side effects from perpetual use of GLP-1 receptor agonists could be. In October, an audit of US health claims was published in JAMA reporting that semaglutide use was associated with a 4-fold increase in the rate of pancreatitis compared with bupropion naltrexone treatment and a 3-fold increase in the rate of gastroparesis. Chris, is this the other side of the coin of the gastric motility model you were presenting earlier?
Well, it is. Definitely the gut motility issues are important. This has come to light because people coming for endoscopy who apparently have fasted overnight still have a gastric residue, which puts them at risk of aspiration. If you haven't emptied your stomach and you've got residual gastric contents, when you're anaesthetized and can't protect your airway, you can get reflux of content and have aspiration of that fluid into the lungs, which is a potentially life-threatening complication. So this has been a focus for both gastroenterologists and anaesthetists as to trying to form some guidelines as to what to do. And I must say that we're really hampered by an extreme lack of evidence to base some of these guidelines on. We don't know a lot about gastric emptying because both Novo and Lilly have resisted attempts to measure this with the best techniques. They favoured the paracetamol absorption test as a way of measuring gastric emptying, which is a very crude method. It associates with the liquid phase of a meal. It doesn't give us good information about gastric emptying. Yeah, there is some evidence that you develop tachyphylaxis for the slowing of gastric emptying when you get continuous exposure to GLP-1. So it's certainly true that the effects on gastric emptying decrease over time, but they're not abolished. And that's what's been ignored, I think, by the industry. And it's potentially now coming back to bite them.
One of the interesting points about the pancreatitis is in that JAMA article, most of those cases came from patients taking liraglutide, not semaglutide. So think about this for a minute. People with diabetes and high blood sugars and elevated triglycerides are at risk of pancreatitis, but semaglutide is far better at reducing weight, triglycerides and blood sugar. And, it may be that the lower rate of this disorder, despite its more potent effect on the pancreas, is simply because they have lower blood sugars and better metabolic control. Mm. Certainly, I don't know of any colleagues who've seen an occurrence of pancreatitis, despite large numbers of prescriptions. And indeed, many people are now prescribing it quite comfortably despite the guidelines for people with prior pancreatitis without any trouble at all.
Yeah, that's pretty convincing. In terms of other long-term outcomes, I've come across one placebo-controlled trial of semaglutide that went on for 2 years. That was a non-inferiority trial in over 1,600 patients with not just diabetes but also established cardiovascular or chronic kidney disease. That intervention was associated with significantly reduced rates of non-fatal MI and non-fatal stroke over the 2 years, though there was no significant difference in the rate of cardiovascular death. This is an important distinction from weight loss drugs of previous generations, isn't it, that typically increased CV risk?
Yes, some of them did increase CV risk. Sibutramine really is the only drug that's been studied in that context, and sibutramine activates the autonomic nervous system or sympathetic drive. Now, you know, cardiologists for decades have been beta blocking people after myocardial infarction. And, you know, here they went out and did a trial where they said, oh, we're going to be fine because, you know, you'll lose weight, therefore your sympathetic activation doesn't matter. That's absurd. The people who make phentermine were clever enough not to do such a trial, and it's flown under the radar. So, you know, there's no such data on cardiovascular outcomes for any of the other drugs, but also none of the other drugs are as effective at reducing weight. We have a drug now that's very effective at reducing body weight, but in order to maintain the benefit, you have to take semaglutide lifelong. And we don't know what the lifelong consequence of this is. We don't even know 7 to 10 years. There are absolutely predictable adverse effects in the terms of loss of lean body mass and loss of bone mass. And we don't know what the long-term effects of those are in terms of frailty, for example. You know, it's perfectly feasible to substantially improve health without losing weight by improving the nutrient profile of your diet, correcting sleep disorders, and obtaining some physical activity, abrogating behavior change and working with patients to have a more positive lifestyle, and then use this as an excuse not to do so. Seems to me we're on a very slippery slope here.
And these drugs will not be a panacea. You know, they're very much viewed that way in the public's mind. It's not that often that a blockbuster drug emerges that's a household name, but almost certainly that means its expectations are overinflated and overstated. There'll be many people who can't tolerate these medications, just don't want to stay on them because they feel bad. And of course, we've got the affordability and the availability issues. It's also worth saying that it's unlikely that semaglutide will remain this expensive in the long-term future. It's got competitors coming in. There are going to be multiple medications which are highly competitive to semaglutide, and so there'll be a price lowering for that reason. So it's definitely not the one all-time solution here.
Many thanks to Chris Rayner and Gary Whithert for contributing to this episode of Pomegranate Health. The views expressed are their own and may not represent those of the Royal Australasian College of Physicians. I've included their declarations of interest at our webpage, recp.edu.au/podcast. At the same page, you'll find a transcript of this episode, complete with links to all the academic references we've cited. And you can carry on the conversation at the comments section there, or on the RACP online community. To make this easier, there's a phone app called RACP The Rock, available for Apple or Android. The website also lists the college members who provided me with feedback in the development and editing of this podcast. I really appreciate all the time and dedication. In the new year, I'll be recruiting some fresh contributors to this motley editorial group. You can send an expression of interest or any other suggestions to the address podcast@racp.edu.au. As always, I recommend you check out the many other video lectures and e-learning modules developed for you. Just do a browser search for RACP Online Learning, or follow the links from the college homepage. This podcast was produced on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I pay respect to their storytellers and healers who came before me. I'm Mick Cavazzini. Thanks for listening.